Hello, I'm Dapper Dan Gavostin, and I own every issue of Amazing Spider-Man, including the annuals, which I say definitely count. Welcome to the Amazing Spider Talk, the show where two fans and collectors uncover the strange, fun, and fascinating history of the Spider-Man comic universe. Thanks for joining us for a special Amazing Friends episode of the Amazing Spider Talk. If you want to swing along with us on our journey through Spidey's past, present, and future, subscribe to Amazing Spider Talk on your favorite podcast app and leave us a review to help spread the word about our show. This podcast exists because of the support of our Patreon members. If you want to receive early episodes, exclusive artwork, and keep this podcast going, go to AmazingSpiderTalk.com and consider joining our Patreon. Today on the show, we're fortunate to be joined by Cody Ziegler, writer of the current ongoing Miles Morales Spider-Man series, which just celebrated its 300th issue. He wrote for Amazing Spider-Man during the recent Beyond era as part of the rotating team of writers. Additionally, he wrote the Spider-Punk miniseries and is continuing that legacy with his new Spider-Punk Arms Race miniseries. Cody has brought a fresh voice to the Miles Morales comics, which Mark and I have been praising in our Substack at amazingspider.substack.com. Mark was unable to be present for this interview, so I was thrilled to sit down with Cody myself to learn more about his process, how he joined Marvel, and a few other surprises he shared along the way. We hope you enjoy the interview.
Well, now let's meet one of our amazing spider friends, the kind of guy I go to other friends who recommend. Find out about the things they created. You'll love them so much that you wish you dated. But you're just friends. They're an amazing friend. A friend, a friend, a friend. They're an amazing friend.
All right. Welcome to the show, Amazing Spider Talk, Cody Ziegler.
Hey, how's it going, man? Thanks for having me. Nice seeing you again.
I'm so thrilled to have you. Well, Cody's saying, nice to see you again. We actually bumped into each other. I say bumped, but I was headed there like a guided missile to talk to Cody at one of my favorite local to the Valley here in LA comic book stores, Galaxy of Comics. You were doing a signing there for, I don't think Miles 300 was out yet. It was the debut of the new Spider-Punk Arms Race number
yes,
one. Is that what
yes.
it was about?
Yeah, that was a big thing. Yeah. Also a shop I've never been to before, but one of the coolest shops I've been into. Like they had, you know, obviously toys and stuff, but also they had like full stand-up arcade machines, which I haven't seen in a shop in a long time. So like, I get why it's your go-to shop. That place has got a cool vibe going on.
It's one of those rare shops that does really well for new books. It's got a great selection of old books if you want to go bin diving. And then they have this entire wing of the store dedicated to kids stuff, which like I really appreciate because someone's got to get kids into comics.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, cool. You know, speaking of getting into comics, for many of our listeners, you first arrived on their radar during the Beyond era of Amazing Spider-Man. Whatever our history is, what's your history with the Wall Crawler? When did you first become a fan of Marvel and Spider-Man?
You know, it's weird. I mean, I feel like it's like one of those things that's always just existed as a kid. Like, I mean, I watched. You know, it's like I definitely watched the TV shows. Like I played the games and stuff, and like I was a big Marvel versus Capcom fan. So like I was always picking Spidey and doing like, you know, his specials and like the web throws and stuff. So like he's always just existed. I don't think I actually read Spider-Man proper until I was in maybe college, like college age. I got into Ultimate Line. Like that's how I first got into like Cape stuff proper, and how I got into Marvel stuff was like I was the Ultimate Universe was made for me. Like knew who the characters were, but like didn't know the backstory. So like I read Ultimate Spider-Man, Ultimate X-Men, Ultimate Fantastic Four, Ultimate Power, the Ultimates. Like, I literally ran through the entire Ultimate line up until like Ultimates, Ultimatum, whichever one where they killed everyone. So that's when I kind of stopped.
Ultimatum, yeah, yeah. It was a good jumping off point, yeah.
Yeah, it was a really cool time. So, like, I got into it there. Like, I read with Peter for, like, the first 100 and however many issues until he, like, you know, died, and then Miles took over. So, like, I was there for, like, 10 years or whatever. So, like, that's how I got into to Spider-Man proper. And how I got into, like, the actual comics is, you know, I was writing on She-Hulk. And Zeb Wells, who, as you know, writes Amazing Spider-Man and writes a ton of comics, he was like sort of the second in command there. And at the time, he was working on this Ant-Man like miniseries. And I just remember looking at him, it was a crazy. I've never seen comics be made. So like he'd be looking at this crazy artwork of like, you know, 20 story bugs fighting like Ant-Man. I'm like, what is this? He's like, oh, this is a comic. I'm like, how do you get into it? He's like, well, let me see how your script turns out for this, and then if I think it like works, I can introduce you to some people. And he liked it, and he introduced me to Nick Lowe. And Nick was like, "Hey, what are you into?" I was like, "Spider-Man, particularly like Black Spider-Man." And like, I only read the Ultimate line. He's like, "Well, that's great because I edited most of the Ultimate line, so it seems like we have sort of similar sensibilities." And like from that, my first ever comic book I ever wrote was a 10-page backup for Miles Morales 25. Like a 10 pager thing. Like I introduced Bumbler. Like that was my big thing. My big introduction to Marvel was introducing a very dumb throwaway character that now for somehow I can't shake him off. So like that really how it started was like Zeb Wells just took a shot on me. And like now I'm still here.
Well, that's so funny because like normally you have to kind of like work your way up the ranks through like C and D list characters on miniseries and things like that. And you're just like, he's like, "Hey, what are you interested in?" Normally you're like, Moon Knight or like Sleepwalker. Yeah. And you're like, what about number one? What about Spider-Man?
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's just shoot our shot.
Yeah. Like, yeah, yeah. You know, closed mouths don't get fed. So like that was the big thing is I did Miles. And then I had to do like my first like book proper was a terrible one shot. I mean, terrible on my part. The art was great. But it was, I think it was Heroes Reborn was like this event they were doing. And I wrote like a Squadron Supreme one shot where like the B and speaking of D list, like the D and C list of the Squadron Supreme. So like, you know, Q and V list and in actuality, we're fighting like Baron Zemo and his team of like Thunderbolts or whatever. And I remember being terrified because it had to be 30 pages and I had only written 10 pages before. And I had no idea how to like cram structure. I was just like a nervous wreck.
They're like, give him the DC spin spoof characters.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, oh, here we go.
Well, so, you know, I'm really interested in this because you're a creator who belongs in a new type of pipeline into comics, which is television. It used to kind of be the other way around that comic writers would use their credentials from comics to hopefully write for TV because that was like the lucrative place to be. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to kind of have flipped. I've heard rumors that comics work is actually more stable than television work, especially with the pandemic and the writer's strike. Can you speak to coming in through television and, you know, maybe other people, you know, bucking this trend in comics?
Yeah. I mean, again, I can only speak from my perspective, but yeah, you know, the end game for me was always writing for Marvel Studios. And like one day I would love to write comics. I was always talking about how I'd love to write comics, even in the She-Hulk room. I was lucky in that like the first job I ever got basically was Marvel Studios. So I was like, oh shit, now what do I do? And like my first comic thing was Marvel Comics. So like I think from my perspective, like, you know, it's definitely easier, I think, in my experiences to go from TV to comics if you have written for like a bigger property. Like definitely it's much easier to go from, you know, She-Hulk and be like, oh, this is co-signed by Kevin Feige. Like Kevin Feige has read my writing and he likes my writing. So like it's easier. I found it much easier to be able to go from that to like writing Spider-Man as opposed to like, oh, I'm writing Spider-Man into writing for like, you know, Ms. Marvel or whatever. I think that's just sort of how it sort of worked out. And like even from our generation and my generation, I mean like those sort of new writers that came up when DC or when Disney Plus was doing that big sort of push for TV shows and movies and stuff, like, you know, Jeff Loveness, Zeb Wells, obviously, Sabir, who was on Ms. Marvel, now is writing Ms. Marvel with Amon, Ms. Marvel, myself. There's another lady in our room named Dana Schwartz, Celeste, who is
Bronfman.
Writing, Bronfman, who is writing Jackpot series and Black Cat, like all Marvel people or Marvel adjacent. Like, so like that definitely was like, that's been my experience, is like, it's definitely easier to break in, and it pays obviously much better in like the healthcare and residuals and like all that sort of stuff that you get from having a union is helpful. When it comes to stability, like, yeah, you know, comics is more stable. You know, you're going to hopefully, you'll probably have a book every month that goes out. And it definitely helped when we were on strike last year. Like, you know, if you notice that I have so many books coming out now, it's because last year I agreed to do a bunch of books because I didn't know when I was going to work again. So like, that's why you have like, that's when you have free time to write an ongoing for Miles and an ongoing for Deadpool and a graphic novel and a Spider-Punk too. I think from my perspective, like for me, because my day job is television writing, I sort of view comic book writing as a hobby that, you know, it pays, which is really nice. But like, I also find myself not necessarily as stressed out as probably some other writers that were probably at my caliber or my class, is that like, if I know that my day job is a union TV show, like I don't have to worry necessarily about, you know, fighting back with like my editors. Like I can just have a sort of confidence in the going into that. Like I know how it's like dealing with like notes from like an executive they can be brutal, and like dealing with a comic book editor in my experience is like such a completely different animal. Like they're so much nicer than like TV notes. And also I think, because I've been lucky enough to work on bigger shows and shows that are like, you know, part of the culture and the zeitgeist and well respected for better or for worse, I think that also has instilled a sort of like confidence that they may have in me. Like I think if you see that, oh, you know, he's written for like Marvel and like he's written for Rick and Morty or Futurama or whatever, like we think that he can probably curate like a 20-page comic book story. I think also because of that, like I may have a little bit thicker skin when it comes to like criticism and like ignoring like I don't read reviews. Very rarely, rare for me to read reviews. Like I would hardly ever go on Twitter and like look up my name, or like if someone tagged me, like I would never it's very rare for me to flip that coin and see what they're saying, whether something good or something bad. But like I think when you make something like and you know that, you know, millions of people have watched it and they all have opinions on it, I think when you have a skin that's tough enough to deal with that, like I think you probably, for me anyway, like I don't get as I don't take it as personal if like someone doesn't like a character, or like if someone has beef with Miles or whatever. Like I don't care as much because, you know, I've been through the fires. Like, you know, it's like, what's that line from Blade Runner, like attack ships on, I've seen things you people couldn't believe, you know, like,
attack ships off the Orion, yeah. Or whatever. I'm so curious that you're saying this, because like, you know, I exist in both worlds. I was a film critic for a long time, and I consider myself a comics critic, even though I'm not appointed by anyone to that position. Like I was a film critic, but like, I find that like comics readers and some of them aren't readers, but still have a very strong opinion, tend to be even more opinionated and vociferous about that opinion than people in television and film are. Is as someone on the receiving end of that, you say you don't look, but clearly you must have some kind of like way to read the temperature of it. Do you find that accurate? Like the comics people are very passionate about what they comment on, or no?
Yeah, it's such a different thing. I feel like comic book reading, at least for the majority, and again, I don't have any science for this, like it's so much more active, I think, than watching a film or TV show. Like I think it's really sort of, maybe it's sort of in the same sphere as video game, where it's not as passive, because if you're a comic book fan, like, you know, you have a local shop that you go to, you get in your car, you take the bus, or you ride your bike, or you walk, or whatever, you go there. Like maybe you have a pull list, so like you've told some employee there to like physically set aside X number of comics in your own little box. You take it, if you're really into it, like you're looking through it to make sure like the cover is the same quality as printing. Like there's so much more that goes into it than I think, you know, just downloading an app and watching on your iPad or whatever, you know. I think also like I've been thinking about this lately as I've been going to more cons and stuff. Like I feel like conventions are like sort of like the sort of last bastion of like, at least in American culture, where like you can go to a place and like actively support art. Like it's the only place I can see where you go and you're like, oh, there are people here that are going to give a literal artist money to like make art. Like it's like people taking commissions, or like, if you're like, you know, making t-shirts or whatever, like it's one of those, it's one of the few places I think where you actually sort of see a group, large groups of people like supporting directly artists, which I think is interesting. But yeah, you know, like also
at any moment, a bartering system might break out.
Yeah, truly. Like, hey, I have this number one. Will you trade me this? You know, it's so interesting. And it's cool seeing like art be supported in that way. But that's my long-winded way of building up to, yeah, I think comic book fans, because of that, or more engaged. And like, also there's this unique cross section where like you said, like you may not even read comics. You may just like collect because you like the art or whatever. So like, you know, it's one of those things where people will come up and be like, hey, I love this cover. I haven't read the story, but like, I love these covers. And I've collected like 3, 4, 5, 6 different variant covers of like a one thing of a comic that they may not even read. Or like, there are some people that come up and be like, hey, no one's ever said anything like really rude to me. It's always been like, hey, basically don't fuck up Miles, or like, hey, can you bring this character back? Nothing. No one's ever been rude to me in my face, but like, you know, I've had other comic creators who have had fans like, not intentionally, but like, you know, you're a little socially awkward, or like you're meeting someone, like they say things that backhandedly can be very insulting, and like, you know, they take it on the chin. But it is funny watching someone get insulted to their face, and like watching them sort of choke it down and be like, yeah, you know, maybe next time, maybe the next arc will be better. Like, I personally haven't had that happen, and I knock on wood, it doesn't happen. But I think also, I also came up doing comedy, so like, you know, bombing on stage is like the worst feeling on the planet. So like, I always like, I people not liking a thing and telling me in person isn't as bad when there's a whole group of like 200 people silent in an audience being like, you know what, this isn't funny. So like, I think also I've sort of had an armor built up that way.
Well, comics used to also have this kind of like protective barrier around it that was like the letters page, and now like on Twitter and social media, like you can get directly, you know, in the face. And like, I look at someone like Dan Slott, who was kind of the first like big guy, like killing Spider-Man off in the age of Twitter, was, you know, sparked a huge backlash. And I've long joked that the fastest way to create 50,000 enemies is to be the lead writer of Amazing Spider-Man. And, you know, I think Zeb is probably going through it right now.
No, it was funny watching when the whole Kamala stuff was going down, and like he had told me like, you know, months before the plan, which is like, you know, came like Feige was like, hey, I don't do this very often, but like, can you please just like do this to like make things in line with Marvel, because we have some stuff we want to do with Kamala. So he's like, fuck, I'm the guy that drew the short straw. People are going to be very mad that I have to kill Miss Marvel. But he was,
it
like,
definitely felt like he drew the short straw and not like, yeah, that was his intention. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's sort of, I felt bad for him because people didn't know that like this, you know, she's going to quote unquote die. It's comic book. She comes back, of course. But like, you don't realize that like when she dies and comes back, like the Miss Marvel is going to be like riding her. So like, I remember when he told me that, I was like, oh, that's so cool. People are going to like lose their minds. Well, they're going to lose their mind because she's died. But also, I think people are going to like really be excited that, like, you know, for the first time that, like, you know, an MCU actor is like going to be actively participating in like creating like the lore of the character and like comic books proper, which is like, you know, sometimes they'll like write short stories, but like having actively engaged in like a run or like a miniseries is a pretty big deal. And like, you know, Amon is like an enormous comic book fan, which I think anyone knows who follows her or her knows anything about her lore, but like, she's genuinely an enormous comic book fan. So like, I was like, yeah, it sucks for you. I'm glad that I don't have to do that. But it was fun. It was funny, like, watching him get savaged online, knowing that he's sort of the guy that had to like answer the call of Daddy Feige to make this sacrificial play.
I don't think they did him any favors. I mean, they, yeah, like, teased it was going to be MJ for a long time. Like, I mean, that was, yeah, poking the bear of all bears. So, speaking of Amazing Spider-Man, you first entered, you know, the world of Spider-Man, you know, proper through in the Beyond era of Amazing Spider-Man. You know, can you tell us about how this came about? I know Zeb invited you into the fold. Can you tell us more about like that call and like what was communicated to you?
Yeah, so like, you know, like I said at the beginning, Zeb and I had worked together on She-Hulk, and Zeb is a TV guy. He had written for Robot Chicken forever. He had his own show, Super Mansion, for like 3 or 4 seasons. Like, he's a guy that's been around the way. You know, we would always talk about how we love the collaborative effort of the feeling of like a writer's room. He's like, we don't really see that for comics. Like, we have like these retreats where like, you know, we'll talk about big picture stuff, but like never in like the nitty gritty of it. He's like, I would really like to try that for an arc for like a comic book series. So like, he basically just like got together some of his favorite writers, like Saladin and Kelly and myself and Patrick. He was like, hey, this is what we're going to do. Like, this sort of the overarching narrative, like a TV room, like where we're going to get to it. But unlike TV, like I'm not going to like rewrite you guys. Like that's like sacrilege to do in comics. Like if another writer rewrites someone, it's not a thing that people do in comics. So like you guys basically have carte blanche, but like here's just basically like a loose idea where we want to go. And like, if you can hit these beats in this issue, or he'd be like, hey, it'd be cool to have like a therapy scene in this issue, Kelly, can you do that? So like really, really small things like that. But really, we'd hop on a Zoom for like, you know, 2 or 3 hours, maybe once every other month, and just like talk through what we're going to do and like, you know, pick what characters we wanted to pick. And like, I was like the one wettest behind the ears. Like I'd written like, you know, two backups and like one terrible one shot on my part. So like, I was like, I'm just happy to be here. So, you know, they were like, yeah, you know, what do you think about Kraven? I was like, I love Kraven. I'll do anything with Kraven. And meanwhile, I'm like, nah, I got no take on Kraven. Like he's fine. But like, I just know that he was like an angry Russian guy that hunts Spider-Man. So like, I was just sort of happy to be there. And like, I think because of that, I was so given.
Was that how this was disseminated? Like you kind of just like, drew straws, but like stood up or raised your hand for the one you wanted?
Yeah, so like Saladin was like, well, since Saladin was writing Miles at the time, so he's like, yeah, like there's not a world, like there's no reality in which like there's going to be a new quote unquote Spider-Man that would interact with like the other Spider-Man. So he's like, yeah, Ben Reilly, who becomes like the I guess the Manhattan Spider-Man is how we're sort of breaking it down. Like he becomes like, you know, the red and blue Spider-Man, and Miles is black and red Spider-Man. So he's like, yeah, they should interact. So like, since I'm writing Miles, like I'll write that. Or like, Kelly was like, yeah, I want to like, I like Misty Knight and Colleen, like I want to do something with Daughters of the Dragon. So they, you know, put them together. And I was like, they gave me Kraven, they gave me a list of people. I was like, oh, I can find an angle with Kraven, which was like, you know, I had two issues and like the whole premise is that like this big corporation backed Spider-Man, blah, blah, blah. I was like, I could see a guy like Kraven, like being sort of irked that like the purity of the hunt is being messed up by this big organization. So then they offered me like a Dr. Octopus thing. I was like, yeah, I would always want to write him. He's fun. He's a goofy guy. Like it's very rare to write like one of the quintessential like Spider-Man rogues. So like they offered me that and they're like, we have room for like one like sort of like standalone thing with like him and Aunt May. Do you have a take on that? I was like, yeah, it'd be fun to write like a detective thing with them where they're like disgustingly horny for one another. And like, that was like my main thing. And like, we would pitch stuff every now and then, but truly the coolest thing is that like, when you have your script done, you're like, man, I don't know if this is working or not. Like you could send it into like the Slack and have like Kelly Thompson or Zeb Wells or so whoever like read your comic and be like, hey, this is working, this isn't working. So like for me, it was cool just having like a team of like some of the best writers in the game and some of my favorite writers. Like I cannot sing the praises of Kelly Thompson's Black Widow enough. Like it's one of the absolute best runs of any comic book, but particularly Black Widow. Like it's like her it's just really, really, really well made, and I can't express that enough. So like,
yeah, no, I love her Captain Marvel too. It's really wonderful. Yeah. Let me ask you about this. You know, I love the writer's room kind of concept for Amazing Spider-Man, especially if it's going to be twice a month or three times a month. And I don't know what your history with the title is. Like, you know, all the way back in the Brand New Day era, they sampled that. And it was, Zeb was one of the original people who worked during that era with the thrice monthly book and, you know, about five or six different writers. But like, I do think that it requires kind of like a steady hand from an editor to kind of keep everything feeling like it fits together, you know, and stuff like that. I mean, did you guys like talk about the kind of overall arc of it and tonally how things fit in there? And this is not offered as a critique in any way. I'm just genuinely curious about like how hands-on editorial was and like what role they played in helping you guys, who I imagine like this 19-part thing, it can be sometimes hard to see the forest for the trees.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is for my, since I was like the newest one there, like I'm sure they didn't hold, they may have, I didn't have the much contact with them outside of like the Zacks and like, or Slacks and like emails or texts to Nick, but like, because basically it was like Zeb. We knew Zeb was going to be taking over Amazing Spider-Man after that. So like it was more like a way for him to like sort of like clear some runway for him and like get like have a fun arc and then like sort of land into like his new run. So like it'd be like, you know, we had like a giant fucking Google Doc with like everything that's happening in every single issue, like major beats that need to happen, like through lines, and like sort of like ideas and stuff. So like that would be checked. We could always check that. Or like, you know, if you reference something in an issue, you would get like an email from Nick or a text like, hey, this actually is going to be happening in another issue, or like this character is popping up over here, blah, blah, blah. Like there's sort of that like minutia that you get with editors is like that I really appreciate, is that like, I don't know what's going on. I don't know what the status quo is for this character, because I didn't know they've been appearing in like 15 other books since then. So like that was really helpful for the actual like structure and through line. A lot of it was like just in a doc, and then also Zeb was spearheading that. So like you could, for me, I mean, because we're friends, like I could get a text from him like, hey, can you massage this a little bit? Or can you put these, like, here's some like areas I would need for a line to help me set up for this issue. Could you put this in there? And, you know, just because I come from TV, I was like, yeah, of course, like, you know, a rising tide lifts all ships. So like I'm used to that. And also it's nice that I get to do the rewrites, where usually like, you know, you pass your script off to your showrunner and then like you're sort of done with it. So like I said, Zeb made a point to be like, yeah, I'm never going to rewrite anyone because like that's just not what you do in comics. And also these are my suggestions. Take them if you want to, but it would help the overall narrative if we could get sort of get to this place.
So like, you know, in terms of like timeline, you know, you came on, you know, in the Beyond era kind of came in. And again, I don't really know your history with Amazing Spider-Man, but like the Nick Spencer run had been going on for a long time. And, you know, I this is speculation, but like the end of it seemed to kind of, I don't know if fall apart is really the right way to say it, but like it didn't really seem like a proper ending. And I've heard rumors about him leaving to go to Substack and kind of leaving the office in a bit of a lurch. And I'm not asking you to comment on that at all, but like when you came onto the book, was there any idea of like, you said that it was like building the runway for Zeb to take over, you know, did you have an idea of like what kind of role you guys were playing in that transition between creative teams? Because normally you just go from one creative team to another. This seemed to be an unusual circumstance that we would get this kind of not even Peter Parker focused book, you know, one that brought in Ben Reilly, someone, you know, you could kind of leave Peter out of it, so to speak.
I didn't have much information for that, but my sense was that also it's like my first time writing for like a big book. Yeah, like I said, I'd only done like two backups in a one shot. So
don't ask questions.
Yeah, the energy I got. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, truly. But my sort of take that I got was that like if you told me that wasn't normal for comics, I wouldn't know because I didn't know. But like my take was that Zeb was gonna be taken over and he was gonna have the big thing was going to be like this sort of mystery. The where was Peter, I think, was like what they were sort of saying. And
sure,
like,
the, right. What did Peter
the
do?
The press, yeah, or whatever. Yeah. What did Peter do? So I think they also wanted to like shift the status quo for Ben Reilly. And that's, I think that's where they also, the pitch for the name Chasm came from. And like where that all that sort of, there's a motif in those 19 issues of like him missing a face, whether it's like a flashback with his uncle Ben or himself, or I guess his biological uncle, Peter's, I guess, uncle in the,
if
in the
you're time a clone, is it still biological?
Yeah.
Questions.
Yeah. Who
ask,
knows? Yeah. But no, like I, yeah, my takeaway, my sort of take that I got away was that like, let's, since we're going to have this switch up between artists or between writers, I guess it'd be fun to just have this sort of like sort of self-contained arc in Spider-Man, which is like it's not Peter, so it's Ben, but also it was a way to get a bunch of people that haven't sort of dipped their toes into Spider-Man. And I think for me, if I had to guess, it was a way for Marvel to be like, all right, can this guy write like a full issue of like a spider person? Because I went from that to Spider-Punk, which I think was like their test for me to see if I can write like, you know, more than two issues back to back of a spider person. So
yeah, I not to interrupt you, but like again, I bring up the irregularity of it, which is to say, like Amazing Spider-Man is normally not a tryout book. You know what I mean? So like, it's cool that you were really there, and I like your issues a lot. But I just find it very curious, the whole thing. Yeah,
Zeb probably had like a lot of sway because he's going to be taking over Spider-Man, and like he's worked with Nick for a while, and I think they enjoyed enough of my one shots with Miles and the, or my backups with Miles and my one shot with Heroes Reborn. And I really think a lot of it just went to Zeb vouching for me. Like, I think this is sort of like not unlike TV, where like, I think a lot of people think that to be a TV writer, you have to have like the best script or the best writer. But really, there are like sort of three piles that a showrunner looks at. It's like, here's the best thing I've ever read in my life. Or like, you should be running this room. Here's the worst thing I've ever written, which is like, you should never touch a script ever again. And the third pile, which is like, oh, this is good. And like, I can see their point of view, which is where an overwhelming majority of writers land, is like, oh, they're competent, they can do the job, and I can see their point of view, and they can be massaged and get to the place they want to get. So I think for me, it was like, oh, this guy can obviously write for a serialized show. Like, he came from the most serialized studio on the planet at the time, anyway. He has a quality. Like, at the time, like, I was the guy that brought Daredevil back into MCU proper. Like, he hadn't been shot for, what was it, Homecoming? Was that the, or Far From Home?
Yeah, he was in No Way Home.
No Way Home. No Home. Yeah, yeah. Originally, that was supposed to be She-Hulk, and then they're like, let's get Daredevil back in there. But so, like, I think there's a lot of trust from, like, that. And again, a lot of it, I think, was, like, Zeb vouching for me. Like, hey, I'm going to take a risk on this guy. I think he's really good. And I think they enjoyed my scripts enough to sort of warrant that. And then also, like, I was very adamant, like, hey, look, I want to write Spider People. Like, I love Captain America. I love Iron Man. I love Thor and Hulk. But like, if they're not doing jokes, like, I don't want to write the book just because that's my point of view. And also, like, you know, I was a comedy guy. Like, you know, it was me and Zeb, like, the two comedy guys as far as like, we made our living writing comedy professionally on TV. So I think that also went a long way for me getting on that.
Well, book. I got to say, hats off for the boldness of everything you just said.
Hopefully I didn't get anyone in trouble, but again, I guess maybe I'm cursed by working for TV. I don't have to be as on my toes when it comes to answering truthfully.
In terms of reveal, I mean, like, that you were like, I'm going to go play in the big leagues. Like, I'm going to write Amazing Spider-Man, and I'm going to, you know, like, it is a big spotlight to throw on, like, a new writer. And yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot, also, like, at the time I had just started Rick and Morty. So I was like, I mean, this job is not an easy job to work on. So I was like, if I can survive this, I can surely survive, you know, Spider-Man. And luckily I survived both.
Very few
so I
people
think
can survive
also
Spider-Man Twitter or any of those things.
I lucked out.
So, you know, but before we move on to like your kind of like Miles stuff, I am curious about like the research that goes into writing like something like Amazing Spider-Man, because like there's a bunch of different camps, you know, that you can get fall into, which is to say, like, you can be obsessively slavish to the continuity, or you can kind of write, you know, a kind of, I don't know if I would say evergreen tale. You can leverage the continuity to tell better stories. And you worked with two characters or two villains, and not to mention Ben Reilly, whose background is about as convoluted as they come. The fact that Marvel made a 19-part series that took over Amazing Spider-Man around a character that difficult to understand the backstory of is amazing to me. I mean, you know, and again, I'm a fan of the Beyond run, so, you know, but I thought it was very refreshing. You know, you tackled, like, Kraven and Otto, and you mentioned, like, the kind of, like, Slack room. And again, this is not meant as, like, a knock or anything, but your Kraven, like, Kraven had recently been rebooted completely, like, in the previous run to be, like, a weird clone. It was, like, this whole thing. And Zeb brought that back in his run recently and did something really, really interesting in it. But your story with Kraven doesn't, like, bring it up at all. And I'm wondering if that was, like, a choice on your part to just, like, not wade into that territory as a writer, or, you know, if that's something you guys were like, let's not focus on that. Or, because at the time it felt like, reading your story, I was like, oh, are we just going back to regular Kraven? Which, you know, frankly is like, you know, might be refreshing because the clone thing is weird. but now we're back to him being a clone again. And so I'm kind of curious, you know, obviously I imagine you're reading the Zeb stuff now, and you've read that, like, he's very much like trying to live up to his father's legacy, so to speak. Oh, well, tell me about this, because like I'm just kind of curious about like the Kraven of it all.
Truth, I didn't put much thought into it. I was like, one, like, I write stuff that I think I would want to read. And I'm like, if I'm coming, also I think the perspective of like, actually this is something that Nick really, that said offhandedly when I first got to writing comics, and I think it may be one of the most useful pieces of like writing sequential story for like one of the big two, is that like, no matter how well established this character is or this book is or how much it sells every month, this is going to be someone's first comic book ever. This is going to be someone's first time read, like they know who Spider-Man is, but they have no clue, or do they really care, honestly, between Peter Parker Spider-Man, Miles Morales Spider-Man, Ben Reilly Spider-Man, Kane, or they don't know who Kraven is. Like, they're like, they'll Google it and they'll look at Wikipedia, Russian Hunter, hate Spider-Man. Okay, like, so I was like, okay, that seems good to me. And also I was like, I got 40 pages, two issues. I was like, it's going to suck up so much time if I had to explain. It's a clone versus a clone, but he wants to be like, I didn't think that much about it, but in the back of my mind, I was like, it's too much runway to like explain. I always thought about that scene in Looper where like, he's like, if I explain time travel, like your head's going to burst. And I'm like, if I have to explain the intricacies of like one clones, how they work within Marvel and like who the Jackal is and what his whole deal is, I was like, that could be 19 issues of just unpacking how clones work. So like, my thing was that like, this is going to be someone's first time reading this character. Like, here are the major beats of what you would probably read in like a general Kraven story. Like, it's not unlike like getting onto a show that has been going on for a while. So like, you have an archetype. Like, we know what Rick kind of does in a situation. We know what Morty kind of does in a situation, or Hermes or Fry or Bender, whoever the character is. And like, that's sort of my approach for that, is that like two issues, get in and out. Like, I'm only going to be here for 5 issues total, counting Doc Ock and the one shot. I was like, I'm not the guy. Cody Zug was not going to be the guy that cracks open the pathos of the Kraven clone in his first soiree into Amazing Spider-Man. And also, none of it was just like, I was so fucking nervous. I was like, this is my big shot. Like, doing a lot of story circle stuff. Like, I was just like, I'm sure people know who that is, but like what that is, but like just like really going over, like making sure like structurally like it made sense and like do the beats make sense. So I was thinking like, if I fuck up this, like I've seen Dan Slott get death threats for writing an issue that someone doesn't like. It's like, am I gonna be the guy that gets fucking literally like death threats because I fucked up Kraven? So like, or whatever my story was. So like, that's my long-winded way of saying it wasn't my forethought. Like, I just wanted to write like a good Spider-Man story. And like, since I was basically just like a day player, like it's not for me to tackle or have to worry about that. Like, I can let Zeb tackle, cause I knew he was going to be doing bigger stuff with his run. And also like, I was too scared to even think about talking about the clone stuff, cause I was just focused on writing two structurally sound Spider-Man.
Thanks
comics.
For answering that. Honestly, like I'm uncomfortable to ask it because like, we are podcasting and we review and criticize these issues, and reading the issue, I was like, you know, kind of bummed that like we didn't address that, but like, I'm also not aware of all of the realities of what's going on behind the scenes and what anyone is trying to value in the 20x pages that you have, you know? So like, I like to peel back.
Yeah, no, I also like my day job. Like, also I was writing for a full TV show at that time. Like, I actually remember that point of time. I was writing it around like May, June, July of whatever. I think I wrote like 6 months before it came out. So like whatever time period that was, but like, I remember I was writing those two issues, trying not to like lose my mind, writing my episode of Rick and Morty. And like, that was my first time writing for them. So like, losing my mind over that. And I was like taking a feature writing class. Like, there was a point of time where like, there's like a 5 to 7 day period where I was like, I would finish writing Rick and Morty, I'd open up and start writing Spider-Man, and then I'd start writing a feature film. And I remember just like feeling genuinely like insane, like a crazy person, to be like, I don't know what is happening. All three of these things are going to be absolutely atrocious. No one's ever going to hire me again.
You know, there is this whole idea of like death of the author, right? What something is created, but like, I really want to know what's going on with the author, you know, because they're the people that are crafting stories that I love as much as I do. Let's move on to Miles. I'll just say it outright. I love your Miles Morales book. I know, like, this is an interview. But
I thought this was going to go the other way, but, like, this is fucking shit.
This is an interview, I know, and, like, normally I don't, like, let my guard down, but I honestly think it's, like, so far the definitive Miles run.
Thank you.
I'm really enjoying it, and I can't wait to see what you're going to do with it next. How did that come about that you've kind of hinted around, like, you know, how you got the Miles book, but, like, what was that like? What kind of things did you have to put together to pitch something like that? And to be the guy that took over after, like, one, an industry legend, Brian Michael Bendis, then, like, Saladin, who's, like, an Eisner Award winning guy, and then it's, like, Cody Ziegler. He's done a couple issues of Amazing Spider-Man, you know?
I remember getting the email and being, like, feeling like a pit in my stomach foremost. Like, this is, like, a dream. Like, I don't have it right. I just moved into a new place and my stuff's not together. But for I have the first they did, like, a combined issue of the first three issues of Miles when it first came out, like issue 1, 2, and 3. And I remember I bought that at that point, I guess 12, 13 years ago, and I've had it bagged and boarded, and I've kept it in every office I've worked in. So, like, my film school, when I was in film school, like, in my desk, I had it there. When I moved to LA, I had it there, and, like, I had it literally behind me. And I remember, like, getting that email being like, fuck, this is like the dream. Like, this is everything I've ever wanted to do. And now, like, you have to, like, do it. And Zeb has this great thing he always says. It's about working in the creative industry where, like, the first time you get the call that you're, like, working for She-Hulk, or you're writing the Deadpool, or you're doing whatever, like, it's like the it's so good, and you get 15 minutes to enjoy that, and after that you're like, I have to, like, do this. And, like, that's exactly how I felt. It's like, man, I have to, like, write Miles. Like, I gotta come correct. And, like, I remember I was just, like, nervous. I said yes immediately, but I was, like, so nervous.
So what was that process like?
Like, a lot of, like, first of all, calling my parents, like, yeah, I'm gonna do this, and then, like, talking to Zeb, just like, hey man, how do you crack, like, an ongoing, like, I've done 5 issues, and, like, I know how to tell, like, a 5-act story, but, like, how do you have tell a story that has no end? Or, like, if you consider your run an end, like, you know, how do you tell 140 issue, or for Solid, 42-act story? Like, that's crazy. How do you do that? So, like, Zeb gave me some amazing, fantastic advice, and I still use this process writing comics today. Like, I still use this process. Like, it's the most helpful thing I've ever heard when it came to, like, cracking a story. And he gave me he said, this is what you need to do to write, like, a first, like, a run, like a 5-issue thing. Like, this is the structure that works for every single comic. This is what I do, and trust me, it's going to work. And I follow that, and I think it worked. But I talked to Zeb, and I put together, like, a pitch doc of, like, what I wanted to do, what my take was. Like, my take was that, like, first of all, it's hard to follow Saladin because he's a fantastic writer, but also he went so big, and he, like, did the cool shit, like, going to multiple universes, fighting future versions of Miles, fighting clones. I was like, I don't know. There's no way that I can touch that right now because I'm so new to the game of, like, writing.
I don't
comics.
Think you'd, like, want to. Like, do you want to out wacky that? Like, that was pretty, pretty wild. Yeah, yeah. Ride. Yeah.
Also, you don't want to. Yeah, it was so big, and, like, I think only Saladin could have made that work. Like, I knew that I couldn't do that, nor that I wanted to do it. So, like, my take was, like, I want to do, like, more grounded, more street level. Like, I also was very, I think I literally wrote my doc that's like, I want to have a bunch of black people in this book. Like, it's crazy to me that, like, there's this black Puerto Rican Spider-Man that's, like, 16, 17. He doesn't hang out with other black superheroes. Cause, like, if I had spider powers, the first person I'm calling is, like, Luke Cage or, like, Misty Knight, or, like, you know, I'm seeing what's going on. Like, so, like, I made a big point about, like, yo, this is going to be a big theme of, like, you know, mentorship and, like, black camaraderie, black community and stuff like that. And I want to really, like, lean into, like, his, like, supporting cast, because I think Saladin did both of them did, but, like, Saladin really, really, I think he fucking knocked out of the park when he created Starling. I was like, that's such a goldmine of a character, and, like, it's a shame that she hasn't had much to explore with outside of, like, Miles stuff. So I was like, I definitely want them to be a part of the life, but also one thing I really loved about the Spider-Man Miles Morales video game is that, like, they gave Miles his, like, enemies his own age, but also, like, a woman. Like, I guess you could say a woman. I think she's about 18, like, she's an adult. Like, I feel like you don't see, like, women, like, rogues very often. I feel like when it comes to, like, Spider-Man, like, Miles Morales Spider-Man, I was like, I love that. I love also that, like, she had a connection to Miles. So, like, my big takeaway was, like, grounded, street level stuff, and then also introducing, like, new character, like, new villains and new supporting cast, and, like, have it sort of be like more family focused, like friend and family focused. And, you know, they liked it. You know, you sort of pitch out like what your first like maybe three or four arcs would be, very, very loosely. Like you could see it going from like, you know, five paragraphs to like three paragraphs to like two sentences, being like, maybe we do this. I don't know.
You're just tweeting your plots at them.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, maybe he slips on a magical banana. I don't know what happens. You know, they liked it, and we made the first thing. We made Rabble. We introduced some characters. They looked me up with it's sort of simpatico. I had the exact same feeling actually with Spider-Punk, is that like the artist Justin Mason for Spider-Punk and Federico Visentini for Miles, like we just get each other so truly, and like it got to the point where like now me and my editor Tom were like, yeah, we literally don't have notes for you, Federico, outside I'll be like, hey, 180 rule, can you put this person on the left instead of the right, like stuff like that. But like
I'll be forever grateful that you put Federico on drawing a hobgoblin battle I like read that issue and just like chef kissed into the air.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, well, it was one of those things where like I learned this from Spider-Punk, is that like me and Justin are like super close now because we work together, but also we have very similar tastes. But like I emailed Federico being like, hey, what do you like to do? Like, what would you like to draw? He's like, thank you so much. If you look at his style, you get it now. But he's like, I draw kind of like how animation is animated, where like I have a big inspiration is like animated fight scenes. So like if you look at his stuff, you could be like, oh, these are like keyframes in like a sequence. So like this is like, without getting into the minutia of like how animation is made, but like, oh, I can follow how this would look animated because it seems like you're looking at like animated thing with Federico. He's like, I want to draw cool villains like Hobgoblin or Green Goblin, and like I like snow. So if you can have snow pop up in an issue, I was like, I got you, dude. So like a lot of it was that, and it wasn't even until like, you know, maybe like halfway through the run, like, you know, maybe issue like 10 or 11, I started figuring out like sort of like what the story is, or like what my take on Miles is. And like I always had big inspiration from like things that I watched growing up, which is like a lot of anime and like a lot of manga. So like that sort of getting in, and then my editor started jokingly calling Miles Shonen Man. So like then we started leaning more into like the anime and manga of it all, and like
300, he went Super Saiyan. Can we just acknowledge that?
It's like, it's one of those things where like, you know, it's like that domino meme where like, you know, one here and one there. It's like, one, I watched Dragon Ball Z at 10, and like, you know, the latest domino is Miles going Super Saiyan and Miles Morales 300. But like, yeah, I just put together a doc of my thoughts, and they seem to enjoy it. And like now we're at the place now where we have a bunch of characters, and like, I'm always thinking to myself, man, I wish I had more issues to like follow this arc or like introduce this character. Like I've gotten a real appreciation as I've sort of gotten along with Miles. It's that like the fact that anyone writing more than 15 issues of a thing can like make it work is very impressive to me. Like the fact that Dan Slott has made as many good comics and they make as much sense as they make, knowing what the structure that he has to work in, and like knowing how the nature, also I only ship once a week or once a month. So like having to do that twice a month, sometimes three times a month, is very impressive. And like, I understand while sometimes you like Akira Toriyama, who recently passed, creator of Dragon Ball, they'd always make fun. They'd always be this running joke that he would forget about characters. I was like, yeah, I get it now. Like, yeah, you forget about characters because you're in this unique space. Speaking about the process of like creating, is that like, sort of like that Dr. Manhattan meme where he's like on Mars, like, it's 1945, I'm watching a thing, it's 1960, I'm doing this. Like, that's how it feels with comics, is that like, you know, you're writing a piece of art that comes out now and has to exist now, but then also at some point it's going to be collected and like a trade paperback, so it'll make context in when like you're reading a story as is intended all together at once, instead of like once a month and waiting 30 days. And also at some point it'd be collected into an omnibus, so like it'll have greater context because you've the entire run together. So like I find myself recently in this place where like, man, it's a unique struggle for myself writing a piece of art that makes sense, that has to exist both now, in the future, in the deep future, and also retroactively in the past by having to connect stuff that happened with two writers before me. And I'm lucky in that like I only have two writers before me. Like I only have Bendis and Saladin. So like it's not like, you know, Amazing Spider-Man, which has been on for 60, 70 years, you know, Stan Lee was writing, you know, Amazing Spider-Man. So, like, it's a unique skill set and something that I've become deeply appreciative of as I've written more Miles. Like, I'm starting to write Miles 23 now, and I'm like, I'm writing Miles 20. So, like, you get to the point where you're like, you're writing things out of sync and they still have to make sense. Like, it's a unique skill set, and I've become deeply appreciative of definitely all the artists and writers and editors, particularly the editors that are on these like long form projects, which do not have an end to the story, because the story has to go on forever.
Well, I have two responses to that. One, in Amazing Spider-Man number one, Stan Lee called Peter Parker Peter Palmer. So, like, you know, even the greats can slip up on something very major. And two, like, it's long been held that the longer a Spider-Man run goes on, the worse it gets. And even Stan Lee and Steve Ditko couldn't hold it together past 33 issues. Like, that run drops off a cliff after that point. So, you know, like, you're in good company if you're worried about that kind of thing. You
know, good.
Yeah. And I love both Justin and Federico. I actually have... if you're watching, if you're a listener and you're watching on video, I have a Mason piece right here and a Vincentini piece right here from years ago. So, like, I feel like I've like spawned it into an existence. Your career jumped out of my imagination, Cody, is what I think I'm trying to say here.
Oh, I appreciate you willing it to existence.
Yeah, that's it. I'm very curious. Your Miles has such a distinct voice compared to the previous creators. And I mean it literally. The writing for his dialogue on the page. Can you talk about developing that voice and your rationale behind it? Because, like, I've always thought that Miles never read different enough from Peter Parker. Like, he always just felt like Bendis was like, well, I'll just write a slightly younger Peter Parker. He'll joke like Peter Parker. But your Miles, to me, is the first one that truly feels like his own unique guy.
Oh, wow. Thank you. You know, I wish I had a very deep thought answer or a big thesis, but really is like, I just write how I talk. And like, I write how I talk with my friends, or like how, like, if I go to my group chats, I'm like, yeah, this is the, this is how we would talk in those interactions. And like, you know, you got to clean it up a little bit, obviously, for comics. But like, yeah, my thought process was that, like, you know, he's a Black Puerto Rican kid who's in Brooklyn. Like, he probably talks like how me and my friends or my cousins talk, you know? So like, it's a lot of it is like, just like flavoring, like dropping G's off of words or contracting things, or like, even like my girlfriend has a 17-year-old daughter. And like, even the way that she talks with her friends is like, I mean, I sound like a grandpa next to them. So but like, yeah, when you're a Black person, like, you talk differently, like, you know, without even getting like code switching and all that stuff. But yeah, you know, Miles is like a young kid in like New York, Brooklyn, of all places. Like, that's how he should talk to me anyway. And like, I just channeled that. So it was like very easy one to one. And like, you know, obviously I have a different sense of humor than Saladin or Bendis. So like, that informed it as well. And also, like, you know, I am like a comedy guy. So like, when it comes to structuring jokes, like, I think of things that way too. But like, a lot of it is just like, Miles just talks how I talk, like, and how my friends talk, you know?
I'm so glad that you've brought it to the book, because it really has brought such a distinct uniqueness to Miles, like, and a time and place for the character that, you know, I think was always Bendis's intention, right? He was like, if we were to invent Spider-Man today, he'd be a kid from Brooklyn. And then, you know, this is no knock on Bendis, but I don't know that it read like a kid from Brooklyn. And yours does, you know, like, not that I'm like completely savvy on what's going on with like teenagers in Brooklyn, but, you know, I just use the word savvy. Yeah. So like, you know, I guess I'm curious about how you as a writer, like, judge that and create that for yourself. You know, like, if you're writing it on the page, you know, are you saying it out loud to yourself to kind of hear it, or like what's your actual process as a writer for something like that?
Yeah, it's very rare for me to say stuff out loud. Like, I did that earlier when I was like writing like TV scripts and stuff to see if jokes land. But like, for Miles, like, because it's so insular, like, it's just me. Like, there's no one to really, I mean, my editors and stuff read it, but like, it's just me. So like, I feel like, because now as a culture, like, we spend so much time engaging in the actual written word of like text. Like this may be the most, like, since the invention of like writing. Like, I think it's maybe the most amount of time that humans have actually literally written things to each other. And like, and because of that, like, you know, because if we spend, you know, if we're on our phones conservatively, like 5 hours a day, of those 5 hours, 4 of them, like, we're probably texting people, or 3 hours, we're probably texting people. So like, because we spend so much time, or I spend so much time, like, literally writing, like, I just, like, that just seems to be so, it seems so natural. And like, there'll be certain things for like characters like Hytel or who's Dominican, like a Black Dominican woman, or like Rabble, who's like Jordanian, who are like, I'll talk to my friends who are like, my friend Sandra, she's Arabic. And like, I'm like, hey, does this make sense? Like it feels weird to me for like a kid to just call their dad father. It seems so like structural. Like, it seems so stringent. Like, what would she say? Like, oh, probably Baba. Like, that's what I would do. I was like, oh yeah, then I'll use that. Or like, you know, I had a bunch of Puerto Rican and Dominican homies when I was in film school, and like, they would argue about food, who has the better food all nonstop. And like, same thing with like Nigerians and Ghanaians, like they'll argue over jollof rice. So I was like, those sort of like things that you see just seems like that should be in that world to make it seem a little bit more lived in, like a little bit more real. So like, if it's something that I'm not feeling that I can necessarily tackle or have the best grip on, like, I usually just like hit up a friend and be like, hey, does this seem real to you? Cause like, the last thing I want to do, cause I know this feeling, is like, you read a book and it seems like, hey, how you doing, fellow kids? Like, you want to go to the skate park? And like, it just seems so inauthentic and so corny that like, that to me would be like my fucking death. Like, to me, the worst thing would be like writing like a corny character that's not intentionally corny, that like, you know, reads as like untrue or false. And like, so like, I'm always very cognizant of that. So like, yeah, I'm used to writing a lot. So like, that's how I write, and like, that's how we speak. And I think it just happens to translate very well for Miles. It's funny enough, like, I had someone sort of bring this question up a couple of weeks ago. I was like, who is it harder to write for, like Hobie or Miles? And I was like, it's interesting because, you know, they're both like young Black Spider-Men, but like, Hobie does have, like, he has a different cadence to me than Miles. Like, he's like a little bit more aggressive. Like, he's not afraid to like kill. But like, Hobie, I think because he's in a world that's so like dystopian, is that his earnestness reads so much more bigger to me than Miles. Like, if you read like Spider-Punk, like, he's very different from like movie Hobie in that like, he's very earnest and like, he's very happy with his friends. Like, he's very stoked on life because everything around him fucking sucks. And like, I think if you took that earnestness and put it into Miles, it would read like a little cornier, I think, just because he's like so gung-ho and Miles is like, hey, I like my friend and stuff. But like, I don't know. That's something that I've been thinking about a lot lately too. And your question just sort of brought it up to me. I don't think I have a definitive answer. I don't know where I was going with that, but that just popped in my mind as I was rambling on.
You don't have to answer this, but I am curious. You know, you worked on that, the like the different like multiverses of Miles books, and there was the Thor book that received a lot of criticism for how it used language in being like perceived as being stereotyped in a certain way. How did that impact you? Like, I guess reading that book or being a part of that team and seeing the book get that kind of, you know, criticism, and then do you reflect on that when you're writing any of your work, like to avoid or, you know, maybe you don't even have to consciously think about that, but like, it did seem like, you know, whatever it is that you're doing is working. And, you know, whatever it is that, you know, was in that book, and I'll leave my feelings out of it, but, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I felt bad for that dude. Cause like, when that book came together, I think it was like 5 issues, right? They were like, hey, we want you to write 2 of these issues. Actually, they were like, hey, do you want to write this? I was like, yeah. And I thought I was going to write everything. So I was like, here's my idea. Like, no, actually, we're going to have 4 different writers do it. I was like, great. And like, they sent 2 of the writers. I was like, oh, I assume they were all going to be Black. Most of them were Black. If you don't, comics, like, it's written at the same time. So like, you know, I had my first issue done, but like, I didn't even have art done for what Hulk or Thor looked like until maybe like a week before we were supposed to go off to print. So like, you know, we had outlines, or like sometimes outlines, sometimes scripts, sometimes you just have like treatments, like beats of what's going on. So like, I read the Thor one. I was like, oh, this seems cool. Like, they were like, I think in the script they're like, or in the treatment, they're like, hey, he speaks like Thor does. Or like, it's like, I'm guessing I'm going to write a mix of like traditional Thor comics with like Miles, how I think a Miles would talk. So like, the way that it impacted me is like, one, like I made the misfortune of making a, having a joke, you know, that Thor has like, you know, by Odin's eye or Odin's beard or whatever. It's like, I made the mistake of putting by Odin's fave, which I thought was very funny. And it was very fun seeing the context of like, I back when I had social media or Twitter, like I sent a picture of that out, like, this is so goofy. And like, although there's a bunch of people like treating it, like, oh, this is so funny, so goofy by Odin's fave, what a funny thing. And then when the actual issue, that issue came out, the Thor Miles issue came out, and like people were like, what is this book? And then I sort of see people would take steals from that book and then that steal from my issue and be like, this is absolute heart garbage. I'm like, man, I'm catching shrapnel. I was like, a month ago, you guys loved this. And also it made me realize that, you know, this is some comforting for me, is that like, you know, as much as people talk about, you know, things that they don't like in comics, or like, you can very easily see this reaction of like, this is garbage. Can you believe they're doing this to Peter or Miles or Gwen? Like, those people also, most of those people retweeting it or commenting it don't actively read comics, because, you know, it's like, because I'm like, oh, this is from an issue that isn't even released yet. And like, so like, obviously this is like a very reactionary thing. And also you'd see people that had shared the image that I posted like weeks ago, I mean, it's so funny now, being like, this is actually heart garbage. So like, that added some context for me as far as like not taking that stuff seriously. But you know, I felt bad for the guy. Like, you know, I think it's one of those things for me. My point of view is that like, this would have really helped to have had like a black editor on this. One, like, if also because we didn't have character designs, like I said, all done. So like, if I would have seen that, you know, Odin was bald, I would not have written that he had a fade. And I think
hysterical.
Yeah. And also, if you had like a black editor who knew what a fade was, you may have given me the note, being like, hey, in this version, Odin is bald, so like, this joke doesn't really make sense.
I'm going to start telling everybody, you know, I have a very serious fade. It's been fading for 20 years, is what I'll tell people.
Yeah. You know, I felt ultimately, I mean, you know, you got to, the art that gets out, it's how it gets out. But like, I think it would have helped to have had some people from the culture be like, hey, for that are like in the office editing, be like, hey, this may read as very problematic. Like, we may save you from getting destroyed online if this comes out. And like, so for me, I was like, yeah, I got like a treatment one day, be like, this is things that are going to happen. And then like, you read the actual script, you're like, oh, maybe someone should have taken you aside and be like, this may not read the way that you want to read.
Do you feel the same way as like the Kamala stuff?
What was the Kamala?
Like her dying? Yeah. A lot of people were kind of like, oh, like she finally gets a spotlight only for her to like get axed, you know?
Well, no, because I knew it was going to happen. Like, I knew that she was only going to be dead for like a month or two before Amon was going to be taking it over. So like, with that context, I was like, oh yeah, I was like, yeah, I understand when people are going to be mad because they don't know the machinations of synergy between brands. So like, they don't know that Kevin Feige, you know, just picked a name out of the hat. And because he works with Zeb, you know, Zeb is a, whether you know it or not, like, Zeb has very prominent figure at Marvel Studios. Like, if there's a movie that's come out in the last 3 or 4 years, like, he has had his fingers on it in some way, shape, or form in the rewriting phase. The ones that you may have hated, also the ones you absolutely loved, like, Zeb probably wrote something in there that you remember from that movie. So like, you know, I think at the time Zeb had just been doing rewrites for the Marvel. So like, he knows Amon, like he has, he knows a one-to-one to the person that's going to be writing it. So like, I felt bad that he was going to get shit. I felt bad for the people that, you know, were getting dragged defending it. And also, you know, I know the perspective of someone that like, you are, this is your only character and they die, like that fucking sucks. And like, you feel righteous anger and like you feel justified. So like, I think because I had context for what was going to happen in their big, big plans for Marvel, like it helped ease that and not take it bad because I know what's going to happen. But if you're blind to that, yeah, I get why you would be mad and you would feel some type of way. Like if I was reading Miles and Miles died, quote unquote died, I would be fucking pissed. And if I didn't have context, and then I found out 2 months later, whoever, like Shameik Moore was going to be writing Miles, like, oh, yeah, that may ease the punch a little bit. But, you know, it's one of those things where like, you're sort of cursed with knowledge. Like, I think because I know what's happening, it made it easier. But I think the big takeaway from the Thor stuff is that like, I felt bad that he got dragged. Also, I felt bad that I got sort of caught up in it. Again, my sort of solution to all this stuff is having more black people on the comic side. Like, I think I saw a couple of comments, people like, why didn't the writers track this? And like, for a technical reason, just because like, those scripts aren't coming in at the same time, like, you know, all these scripts were written basically at the same time or near the same time, but also like, we're not getting paid to rewrite some guy. Like, there's just someone that they hire that to do this. Like, it shouldn't also be our responsibility to, like, you know, look through a fine tooth comb everything that comes out. But, you know, that's just my take on it.
Well, I appreciate you talking about that. I'm curious, you know, writing Miles, you know, how has the success of the Spider-Verse movies changed the trajectory of, like, writing that character? I know that you've kind of only been in the character for, what, about almost 2 years now? So, like, you know, Across the Spider-Verse is, you know, what, about a year old at this point, the time of this interview. But, like, it's got, like, those films have got to impact you in some way, I imagine. I mean, their Miles is a different Miles. Like, I mean, even just down to, like, the Miles in the comics, you know, is not, like, an artist, you know, so to speak. Or that's not a heavily influenced part of his personality. But, like, that is, believe it or not, like, the Miles in those movies is the more well-known character than the one in the comics. Do you feel a pull to, like, draw him closer to that character?
No, not really. If anything, I feel more of that for Hobie, like, because he was such a breakout from the movie. But no, like, I think, you know, there's never been any mandate for any type of synergy between the movies or the comics and stuff. But I've always been of the mind that, like, there, Miles exists in three different categories to three different types of people. And sometimes there's overlap. It's like, you know, comic book Miles, most people probably know movie Miles. And then after movie Miles, most people probably know Miles from the video games. So, like, Miles Morales video game or Spider-Man 2. So, and, like, there's obviously a lot of those overlap. But, like, as far as, like, eyes on screen, like, Spider-Man 2 was, like, the best-selling game for PlayStation for that year. That means that millions more people are reading or playing that game than they are reading the comics. And, like, however many millions of people saw Spider-Verse, you know, that's how it is, that is to me. So, like, those are also three very distinctive Miles, and, like, there's some overlap, but, like, they're three distinct personalities. So, like, that's how I have sort of viewed it. Like, they're different people. Like, there's no real interplay other than, like, stuff that I think is interesting. Like, I thought, like I said, I thought the Tinkerer was very interesting from Miles Morales Spider-Man. Like, she was a big influence on Rabble, but there wasn't, like, a mandate that I had to make this character. It's more like, oh, this is cool. Like, I would like to see more of this type of a character in this archetype in Miles's world. And, like, if there's something that happens, well, actually, I'm sort of lucky in that, like, since I don't do any multiversal stuff, like, I don't really have much influence from the Spider-Verse films. Like, I feel like that was more like Saladin stuff. But, like, if there's something that I think is really cool and interesting and that I think would work also well in a comic form, like, I would definitely take it. Like, from Spider-Verse, like, me and Jason loved the combat boots that Hobie had. We loved his piercings, and, like, we wanted to give him a hair redesign. So, like, stuff like that influences, but there's never been, like, a mandate from editorial or anything. It's like, what I have, we have to sync these guys up.
I am curious about, you know, I loved Rabble. I think she's a great villain. And, yeah, I can definitely see the similarities to the one from the video game, which is also, I thought, a great character. But what I love the most about Rabble is that you brought back the kind of, like, lottery system that Bendis introduced in, like, the first issue of Miles Morales. And, like, no discredit to Bendis, he never really touched it ever again. I think the whole idea of, like, of Miles being at this kind of, like, elite boarding school is just such a, like, great territory to explore, which I think you did wonderfully with that villain, in this kind of sort of being cheated out of a position that Miles is, like, not utilizing. And there's a real interesting, like, guilty thing there. Like, did you have, like, a list of things that you kind of, like, wanted to touch back in on? Like, one of the other great ones that I, like, would love to see reflected, and this is not to give you an idea or anything, but I just mean generally, is, like, Peter had this loving uncle that died passing on a great lesson to him. Miles was caught up in his uncle's death in the same way, but his uncle told him he would become a villain before he died. And I don't think Bendis ever really picked that back up again. Did you, like, do a reread of these comics and, like, go, like, these are the things I want to touch when I approach my run?
I reread some of my favorite issues, but I made a big point of, like, I don't want to reread this stuff because I know it's going to influence me more than it already has. And, like, I don't, and also made one of the things where, like, I mean, I have a great idea for this, and you may forget that something is touched on. And like, I'd rather my editor tell me that they've already done this than me like read it in real time. It's just gonna like, I knew it was gonna suck out any motivation I had. But the thing about the, so I came into it with like, I knew I wanted to do commentary on something, as much commentary as you can give in a big comic book, big two comic book. But like, yeah, for me, like, I think the lottery system is weird. Like, it's one, the education system is built where like, kids can't get an equal education. They have to literally gamble their future on this. And even then, like, you're not guaranteed that once you finish school, you can afford to go to college or you can get into a good school. Like, all that stuff to me, it seems so ghoulish. And it just seemed like the perfect end for like a classic, what I perceive to be a classic Spider-Man archetype villain. Someone who's been wronged by a Spider-Person outside of their own control. And it just happens that Rabble, you know, is a person that is also, you know, has like every good villain should be the hero in their own eyes. And like her manner that she goes about it is very, very misaligned with morality. But like, you know, her point, she's not mad. I've said like, she's not mad at Miles. Like, she's mad at the system that created her. And Miles just happens to be the thing that breaks her mind. And she only hyper focuses on him. Like, and her like flashback, you see that she doesn't deal with humans very well outside of her parents. So like, she hyper focuses on things. And her instinct is like talking to machines, because it's Marvel. She has a power. She can talk to machines and stuff. So like, the way that she sort of reconciles with like this failure and like not living up to her standards that she, this big sort of standard that she thinks her parents have placed on her, is that she takes on Miles. And like, the truly like fucked up sad thing is that like, her parents would not have cared if she got into a good school. She just wanted her to be happy like that. And she, like, that's all that they wanted. So like, by her like going down this path and like struggling, like having this task of wanting to hurt Miles and kill Miles, like, she disappointed her family. And like, she, like, in the 300th issue, you know, you sort of see her start to like sort of like deal with that and like make, you know, cognitively recognize that. So like, I just wanted to have commentary on that, which I thought was very, you know, sort of a thing that I think should be, you know, phased out or like talked about within the confines of comic. And Marvel was like totally fine with me doing that.
Well, I am dying to see how 300 resolves. What a cliffhanger to leave.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I think it's fun.
Yeah, it's fun. And, you know, I love that you're playing with real stakes there. I'm curious, let's move over to Spider-Punk really quickly. You know, what's the story behind your two runs on Spider-Punk? Like, where did this come from? And did it come out of the same kind of thing? Like, you were doing it successfully with Miles and they offered you more? Or did you have like some burning take on Spider-Punk that you wanted to get into?
Yeah, well, I mean, when we did the first Spider-Punk, like, the editor, Danny, was like, he texted me, or he messaged me one day, hey, do you want to do Spider-Punk? We have reason to believe that people may enjoy him. He may have a certain resurgence of like interest in him. I was like, all right, well, he's obviously in the next Spider-Verse movie. So we made that. And like, truly, like, we said this in every single email, like, Justin, Danny, and our colorist Jim, like, we were like, this is the most fun we've ever had making anything. Like, the most fun I've had writing, the most fun Jim has had doing color. Which I think if you look at the colors for that book, like, it's some of the coolest. Jim takes such big swings that you don't traditionally see in that type of like superhero coloring, is I think usually seen in one lane, and Jim goes the complete opposite direction. Same thing with Justin. Like, we just have so much fun making the fucking book. And once Spider-Punk came out, you know, the trade paperback was the best selling thing that year for Marvel, hands down. Like, it went through, I think, three printings. It was the biggest thing that sold for Marvel.
Wow, congratulations.
Year. And thank you. And I think also, you know, because he was such an enormous hit in the movie, me and Jess would be texting like, when can we do another two? And it's like, I think because people love him so much and it sold out this much, we can definitely do a number two. So like, we just basically browbeat Danny for weeks and finally was like, all right, boys, we're coming back for one more ride. So like, you know, that was really it. And again, this is so much fun we've had, like, this one, because the stakes are so much lower. We wanted the stakes lower. Like, you know, how do you top killing the president of the United States? Like, we decided to go, you know, a little bit more self-contained in the neighborhood. So like, this one is a lot, we've had a lot of fun as far as like references and like inspiration, like, you know, not spoiling anything. Like, you can see the stuff that me and Justin are into towards definitely issue 3 and 4.
Do you
and
have like a background in punk rock music? Is that something you've been into in your life?
Oh, Yeah, yeah. I was in a bunch of shitty punk bands when I was in high school. Like, I played guitar. Yeah, I was. We were terrible, terrible, terrible bands. But I, you know, I was in the scene, as much of a scene you could have in rural North Carolina. Like, listen to punk music, played punk music, still listen to punk music. I made a Spotify playlist when I was writing the first Spider-Punk, and like everything on there was stuff that I was, is a mix of stuff that I listened to when I was in high school and college and like newer stuff. But like, yeah, that playlist is a pretty good amalgamation of stuff that I was into when I was growing up and stuff that I'm into now. So
how'd you get into, I was part of the punk scene, believe it or not.
Cool.
But
yeah,
I'm
yeah.
a little bit older than you. And so like, I'm always amazed when younger generations are still into punk.
I don't know how, I mean, it was like a gateway drug. You know, you listen to Blink 182 and then you hear like Sum 41 and then like you see someone like a Dead Kennedys shirt. You're like, what is this? And like you listen to Dead Kennedys and then you start getting into like zines. Like I think Maximum Rock and Roll was still a thing that was around there. It's like a lot of zines and like before Spotify or like Google. So like you just had to have someone's like cooler older brother to like pass along like his crappy beat up mixtape that he made for you. But like, yeah, that was like my favorite band when I was in high school was like Dead Kennedys. Like I listened to Give Me Convenience or Give Me Death like maybe every single day of 9th and 10th grade. Like that was like my band. And when I got into college, I got back into it again. So like, yeah, I just fucking loved punk and like the idea of writing like a black spider man that liked punk. I was like, this is the easiest thing in the world with my, you know, my tattoos and piercings. And at the time, I had like wild pink hair and I was wearing like combat boots. So I just like, yeah, this is totally what I was like, Danny, you could not ask for an easier thing for me to do than to write a book about a Spider-Man that lives in a punk universe.
Well, on that note, your approach is very different than the sort of like more punk rock metaphor of Jed McKay's stories. Like those were really like rising up against like corporate, you know, America is represented by Norman Osborn, who's in brains get splattered all over the ground. And like, it really was operating in this sort of like purely metaphor kind of thing. Can you talk about like your approach to like what makes of something a Spider-Punk story if it's not going to be a broad metaphor, which is not to denigrate it in any way. It's a different type of storytelling. What do you think defines a Spider-Punk story?
Yeah, well, I will say that Jed actually had a lot of DNA was taken from Jed, particularly the story where he does kill Osborn for the first time. But like the coloring, like that sort of energy, like I really resonate with that. I think from my point of view is that like I want to take that, but also not make it seem so like dour. Like I think there should be some joy in this world. And like for me, I was like, I remember being like, you know, one of the few black kids in my super southern conservative hometown. And like, when you have that like found family, like that's sort of like what brings you peace. And like you can be hard and cold to the world or outside of you, but like when you're with your friends, like I feel like you should let your guard down a little bit. And like part of that was like I think it would be cool, like I think Hobie has two faces, as we all have many faces, but like when he's facing down like Craven or Osborn, he has his hard face, he'll doesn't give a shit, he'll fuck you up, whatever. But like he should be excited to be around his friends. And like I really wanted to build community into it, so that's why he lit the spider base is like just a Brooklyn community center. Like he does a lot of mutual aid, which like I do a lot of mutual aid with coincidentally a bunch of like former punk rockers out here in LA. So like a lot of it was that. Like I think Jed's thing was like spider, he was called Spider-Man, like he didn't like being called Spider-Punk. And I was like, well, it's for me, it's a one-to-one culture, like a black thing, like take something that you don't like and then retake it and recontextualize it and empower yourself by being called that. So like that to me was like Spider-Man or Spider-Punk a bit. And I was like, well, what can I talk about like culturally wise that like they will let me talk about? So I was like, well, I mean, over-policing, fascism, like it, can we just like out and out kill the president? And they're like, I guess. And they're like, the only thing we won't let you do, like originally I wanted to have all the cops in Washington have the Punisher logo and have Frank Castle.
Oh man,
be like
that
would have
been so great.
And they're, yeah, and they're like, we can't do that. We just absolutely, it's not going to be worth us dealing with the headache of doing that. It's like, okay, but like, you know, it's a lot of it. Like, if you read it's very broad, like you said, but like, you know, Wilson Fisk, he's a capitalist who has taken over a city and he like hoarded all the wealth for himself, whether it's medical supplies or like food. And like, you know, the way that they take him down is like someone from that community, which is Matea, taking him out. And like you get to D.C. and it's just a police state with like all these like far right conservative neo, you know, alt right folks that support Osborn with like saluting his literal statue of him in the Lincoln Memorial. So like, you know, it's, you know, as close as we could to being like, hey, we, these are things that we don't support over policing. Like, you could have Hulk say Hulk smash all cops. Like, you can, like, you have to be broad, because for me, like, it has to be like a little goofy, and in order for you to like get that message across. And like, that to me is what I found worked with that. I think it's one of those things with like, you're also writing a book that has to appeal to like people from a large age range, like people that 8-year-olds are reading this because it has bright colors. There are people that are like our age reading it, people that are older. And like,
I, you would know, not give an 8-year-old Jed McKay Spider-Punk books.
Yeah, I would not do that as well. But funny enough, my first comic I ever got when I was around that age was Spawn number 3. My dad bought me Spawn number 3 for some reason. He obviously hadn't read it, and that book is not something that an 8-year-old should read. But it's one of those things where, like, how do you have commentary on a social issue which you think is important, or a cultural issue that's important, that one has to work within the confines of, like, a Spider-Man book, has to work in the confines of a large corporate entity, and also has to sell and be good at also reach a bunch of different people that also can maybe gleam away from that message. And like, that's sort of like where I landed with that first Spider-Punk Battle of the Bands. Like, this seemed like the most fun, interesting way for me to talk about this message, but while also having a fun Spider-Man story.
Man, I so connect with that found family element, you know, like, even if you watch like classic punk documentaries, like Another State of Mind or something like that, where like you see the true bond isn't even really the music. It's like the people you find who are maybe coming from bad homes and find a sort of family in the band culture. And I really got that out of your book, as they're in their spider van driving around the country.
Yeah, I mean, also that was like some of the fun, is like going on like tour, like getting in your friend's shitty station wagon and going to play a crappy church show is like the coolest thing you could do in that age. And speaking to like the community of it all, like, you know, if you seem like you know your punk history as well, but like, you know, a large section of those punk people growing up were like Black and Chicano and like people of color that was sort of erased from the history of punk rock. So like, when I made the book, I was like, yeah, the Spider Band should be all people of color. Like, that makes sense with the history of punk rock. And like, I think it'd be very cool and powerful for like a young punk person seeing that. So like, you know, that's why we have like Hobie, and like, that's why we sort of retconned Captain Anarchy to be like indigenous, and like, that's why we have Kamala, and we made Matea like a Chicano. That's because like those people existed in the punk rock scene, and like, it would be really powerful, I think, to see that represented in the book that you're reading about punk rock.
I feel like you've had a lot of fun with their power sets too, in the arms race, like even just the latest issue where like, yeah, they're parachuting in on Miss Marvel and stuff like that is. It is a blast. Well, anyway, so let's finish you off here, because you've been really generous with your time. And I'm going to ask you a question that I ask everybody who comes on the show that's a creator. But I'll ask you about it with Miles instead of Peter, which is to say, given how Miles embodies the idea of anyone can be Spider-Man under the mask in such a distinct way, what has working on like the first Black Latino Spider-Man meant to you personally?
I mean, it's meant a lot, because like, that was the first time, whenever Miles took over Spider-Man proper, that first,
sure, Ultimate
out,
Fallout, I remember, number 4.
Yeah, I remember I told my roommate, there's gonna be a Black Spider-Man. He's like, word, let's go. So like, we drove to the comic book shop in our we were in Savannah, Georgia. We were both in film school. I remember like driving to the comic book shop. They were sold out, but they had like, it had been out for a while, but they had that that combined issue, that first 1-3 issues, and I bought that. I remember like looking through Miles and being like, oh, he looks like my cousins. Like, he looks like me when I was that age. Like, I can just resonate to that. And I was like, is this what it always felt like? Is this what like a white kid reading like Spider-Man like number 25 was like? This, because I was like, oh, I get this feeling. This is a very powerful feeling. That's sort of what I wanted to do with Miles. And like, still to this day, like the moments that I enjoy the most at like doing cons or signings is when like, you know, a young Black kid or like a Latino kid comes up and they're like, this means a lot to me, and like it's cool seeing myself, or like, or particularly like, I've had kids or parents come up and be like, hey, this is like so and so, like he is like Miles, like he's his mom's Black, his dad's Puerto Rican or whatever the thing is, and like it's just cool seeing himself and our family represented. I was like, yeah, that's great, that's exactly what I want. Like, I want people to read a book and be like, oh, this, I see myself in this. That's why like I've made such a point to introduce bigger, more characters, like more villains or whatever. But like, you know, he lives in New York. New York should look like New York. That's just what I want. Like, I want people to read a book and be like, oh, I see myself in the pages of this book because I understand the power of that. So, like, if I have any influence to do that, like, that's what I'm going to do with no apologies.
Well, thank you so much, Cody. I could ask you 100 more questions, but we're going to leave it there. I thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me.
All right. It's that time. Time for all good things to come to an end. So we wanted to say thank you to you, the listeners and viewers, for tuning into this episode of The Amazing Spider Talk. And an extra special thanks to Cody Ziegler for coming on to talk to me about all of his work with the Spider Office. This podcast exists because of listener support on Patreon. For only $3.99 a month, you can help support our show's existence while getting early episodes, including these reviews the same weeks the comics release, exclusive artwork, and a ton of other bonuses. Thank you to everyone who already supports us and the work that we do. Mark and I really want to increase all the awesome work we do in 2024, including more interviews with modern creators just like this one. So if you are already a patron or want to become one, please help us to meet our goals and make this a better podcast by considering supporting our show. Just go to AmazingSpiderTalk.com and click on the big Patreon button to get started. This podcast episode was edited by Rick Coast. The video version of the show is available on YouTube and was edited by Alex Galucky. Our artwork comes handcrafted by artists Ron Friends, Sal Buscema, and Nick Cagnetti. Our theme songs were produced by Rylan Bojack, Tony Thaxton, and Spider Madge. And our animated intro was created and performed by Josh Sutton. So, until Odin starts rocking a fade, our motto will always remain, with great podcasts, there must also come the amazing Spider Talk.
Don't miss the next installment.